Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of August 17th, 2012. This hour, we visit one Los Angeles neighborhood where the impact of the foreclosure crisis is more than just financial.
A lot of our local gangs would move into these houses at night. They take it over. They trash the house out even more. They tag it with all their graffiti.
Plus, 7 years after Hurricane Katrina, a jazz musician reflects on life after losing everything.
If this were to ever happen again, a storm, something of this magnitude, financially, I would be in a much better place. My saving, 10% of everything you earn is yours to keep, and I live by that religiously.
And New Orleans native Wendell Pierce, you may still call him the Bunk, updates us on his dreams of a Big Easy grocery store.
Our focus is going to be on affordability and customer service, and it will lead to what I know can happen, where we can do well and do good all at the same time.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
I lost track a long time ago of how many reports we've done on the foreclosure mess, how many homeowners we've talked to, and banks and politicians, how many solutions have been proposed and ignored. 4 or 5 years after the bubble popped, the narrative hasn't changed much. But today, a perspective that maybe you haven't heard before from Officer Eric Young of the LAPD Southeast Division.
We're going to go to the east side of the division, which is north of Imperial Highway and east of Wilmington Avenue.
So as we head over there, talk us through what you have seen over the last 4 years as the housing bust has hit this division.
You know, several years ago, property crimes took a back seat to all the violent crime we had. But now, as our violent crime goes down, the department, the city, we're focusing more on our property crimes.
Property crimes. Burglary, trespassing, vandalism, all hallmarks of the foreclosure crisis.
Just real quick, where we're going is we're going into watch, and it's not, you know, I'm not going to say something terrible is going to happen, but you never know what's going to happen around here. I mean, on occasion, police cars get shot up.
We were heading out on a tour of what the foreclosure crisis has wrought in Watts, an area of Los Angeles infamous for riots and gangs, and these days, boarded up vacant homes. More than 1,500 foreclosure actions over the last year in a single zip code, according to RealtyTrack. And before we arrive in that zip code, a warning.
You know, I'm not going to be doing any traffic stops or anything like that with you guys in the car. For safety reasons, though, if anything happens, just push this orange button on my radio. If I can't do that, this little orange button right here, and they'll find us, okay?
Officer Young has served in Southeast Division for 12 years. His area of responsibility is the smallest in size, highest in crime. But it's the evolution in the type of crime he battles that brought us to this ride-along.
4 years ago, no, I'd say about 3 years ago, it was probably at its worst. On any given day, I'd probably have 45, 50 vacant homes in my area. And the blight it brings to the street, they just look like crap.
There are 68 documented criminal street gangs in LAPD Southeast Division. Because of the foreclosure crisis, those gangs and the area's homeless population have a whole lot more housing to choose from.
This is an interesting place right here. It's sat vacant for about 2.5, 3 years. There was a homicide in that garage that went unnoticed for quite some time.
What is quite some time?
Probably a couple weeks before we got to it.
2 weeks?
Probably. It was pretty much based on the smell that it created. So we're going to park the car right here.
We parked in front of a boarded-up split-level house fronted by a wire fence with a big hole cut out of it. The lawn was dried up and brown. Our story was prompted by lawsuits filed by the city of Los Angeles against the banks that own these kinds of foreclosed properties. The city claims the banks should be responsible for the upkeep of abandoned homes. The courts have yet to rule. This house on Calmia Street is in foreclosure. 2,300 square feet, list value $115,000 on the real estate website Redfin.
As of this morning, these homes are owned by J.P. Morgan, and
how long have they been unoccupied?
3 years, at least.
3 years?
At least, yes. And the fence and the wood on the windows and everything, that was done by the city. Hey, how you doing, bud?
Pretty good.
Hey, who you with?
Turned out that morning, a crew from Field Asset Services showed up at the house. FAS is contracted by banks to send cleanup crews to abandoned properties all over the country. William Perez was the crew chief for this job on Kalmaya.
I started 3 years ago, and my cousin told me there would be 6 days a week, 80 hours a week. I laughed at him. Oh, come on. You're not serious. 6 days a week, 80 hours a week. That's what we got. People say it'll slow down, but with the amount of houses that are on foreclosure already, I'll be working for the next 2 years straight. Hello? Hey, Ben. Yeah, I don't know if I could finish it today because there's a lot. There's, I think, 60 cubes.
60 cubes is 60 cubic yards of trash on this property. The city is supposed to fine property owners, i.e. the banks, $1,000 a day for houses that aren't cleaned up. But officials say they don't have the budget or manpower to track down and inspect all the foreclosures in L.A., so the fines go uncollected.
Be super careful where you step, guys. But this is typical of what you'll find in a vacant home around here. This is very typical.
Officer Young made his way to the back of the property through broken window glass and more trash to a garage strewn with filthy mattresses and drug paraphernalia and plastered in graffiti.
Okay, the gang took it over. This is Fudgetown Mafia Crips. I mean, that's their gang sign, you know. So they were here first. And then come the people, the homeless people, you know, the narcotics users. And this is good dig. I mean, you know, you got four walls and a roof. Living large.
But this is the detritus of actual living in here. I mean,
this is someone's house.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, someone lives in the garage. Please be careful where you step.
Yep.
I know I keep saying that, but...
In this particular property in Watts, we've had crews out at the property on average once a week for the past 4 months.
Gary Kishner is a spokesman for JPMorgan Chase.
And unfortunately, at this particular property, individuals in the community have been dumping.
Banks facing the same problem across the country also say that they are not in the business of owning and maintaining homes. They make loans. Jenny Schutz of the USC Price School for Public Policy says corporate entities simply are not equipped to handle millions of empty foreclosures.
They don't want to be maintaining the lawns. They don't want to be doing the exterior maintenance, doing security. And they also haven't been able to sell them and get them out of the inventory because we have such a glut at this point. So you really have an entity now owning these that doesn't know how to manage them.
And the question of responsibility gets even more complicated if the loan was securitized and the house is technically owned by a batch of investors all over the world.
Oh. Hey.
All of that is, quite frankly, irrelevant to the people living near these blighted homes, whether they're in multi-million-dollar subdivisions or far down the economic scale here in Watts.
That means people are going over there to the vacant property. They urinate and trash.
48-year-old Elaine Brown came out of her home across the street. She's lived there since March.
You know, I could come home late at night. I don't know, and it's so dark over there. I can't see, you know, when I'm coming home, who's over there, who could come out of there and jump out on me.
Who do you blame for this situation?
I blame the banks. Bottom line, I blame the banks.
What do you think they should have to do?
Really, to be honest with you, because it's moving too slow for a buyer, tear it down. Tear it down, and that's it.
We left Kalmaya Street with Perez and his crew still figuring out just how much junk they'd be hauling away. The owner of a corner store nearby told us all the foreclosures were keeping people from buying other homes in the neighborhood, which means fewer customers for him. And Officer Young? Well, he just wishes he could stop dealing with all this property crime and go back to community policing.
I got to be honest with you guys. I was slightly embarrassed to show you what I showed you today because this is my neighborhood. I'm responsible for this neighborhood. On the other hand, sometimes I find myself asking, where do I draw the line between, like, police officer and, you know, dealing with the mess that other people created? It's not necessarily, you know, a crime in progress. But with this job, I'm somewhat expected to do that, you know, but... It is getting better, I can tell you that, but I don't know how long it's going to take.
How are you seeing that manifest?
I just don't have nearly as many vacant homes as I used to have.
Well, Officer Eric Young, we really appreciate the tour. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
I enjoyed having you guys. I always like a little company in the car with me, so it's cool.
Yeah, it's for entry, just so I guys know. We had that signal a bit ago, but no longer have it.
Thank you.
Seems everyone has an opinion about baby boomers. Love them or loathe them, their sheer numbers mean boomers are a major force in the economy. Commentator Judy Muller is one of them. Today we debut her new regular segment, Senior Moment, Judy's exploration of her generation and its entry into retirement.
The tragedy of old age, wrote Oscar Wilde, is not that one is old, but that one is young. I recently turned 65 myself, but in my head I hover right around 16. It was a good year for me, and I like to hold on to it. And I'm not alone. A lot of 60-somethings, and 70-somethings for that matter, tend to redefine the term old age with each successive birthday. For me, old is now right around 85. Still, my real age puts me squarely at the forefront of the baby boomers, a huge bulge in the population that annoys other age groups simply because there are so many of us poised to suck the lifeblood out of Social Security. Unfair, I say. I mean, can we help it if our parents were overly amorous after World War II? At any rate, here we are, a huge number of boomers about to enter our golden years with a huge impact on the economy. An impact too big to ignore. Every 8.4 seconds, another baby boomer turns 50. By the year 2030, 20% of the U.S. population will be over the age of 65. I can see how those numbers might sound like an advancing plague of locusts, but consider this. These 78 million people account for more than 50% of discretionary spending. They don't call us the me generation for nothing. The mind boggles at the goods and services that could be developed. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the boomer and older generations now represent a $2.6 trillion annual market. And reaching them is hardly a problem. One in three Facebook users is now over the age of 50. That's a total of 4 million boomers and seniors with Facebook pages. Instead of seeing the boomers as a cash drain on the economy, we could be seen as cash cows. And here's another factoid to ponder. Recent studies show that baby boomers now boast the highest growth rate of entrepreneurship in America. The lowest rate? That belongs to the 20 to 34 demographic. That means seniors could have it both ways, cashing in on ourselves, the ultimate in me generation economics.
Judy Muller teaches journalism at USC's Annenberg School for Communication. And yes, she is totally cool with calling this segment Senior Moment. At least I think she is. I can't remember, actually. Now that Uncle Sam has toughened up the rules for overdraft charges and credit card swipe fees, banks are finding all kinds of new ways to make up for that lost income. As a result, it is getting harder to avoid checking account fees and all those other charges, and consumers are finding fewer options for avoiding them. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has our story.
Don't look now, but it seems even credit unions, which have been a haven from rising fees, aren't immune from the pressure to charge more.
Credit unions have been impacted by many of the same regulatory changes that have impacted bank revenues.
BankRate.com's Greg McBride says among the country's 50 biggest credit unions, the number still offering free checking with no minimum balance is shrinking from 76% last year down to 72% in the latest survey. Still, McBride points out that leaves a sizable majority not charging more. He says their not-for-profit status means credit unions aren't as quick to pull the trigger on raising fees.
Many of them will continue to have not only things like free checking, but much lower hurdles in terms of balance requirements or what's needed to avoid monthly fees.
There's a greater likelihood that you'll be paying more for banking at a bank. At MoneyRates.com, senior analyst Richard Barrington says his survey usually shows various banking fees going up and down.
This time around, we saw average fees and minimums rising across the board.
And the least you'll need to keep in your account to get free checking has jumped on average by more than $800.
That balance requirement is now over $4,400, and that's beyond what most people tend to keep in their checking accounts.
Even so, Barrington says a third of the banks surveyed still offer some kind of free checking, most often smaller community banks or on the Internet.
Online banks are not burdened with the extensive overhead costs that are involved in having a big branch network, and so they often are able to offer either cheaper accounts or higher interest rates on things like savings accounts.
Barrington recommends consumers keep looking for the best deal. With more than 7,000 FDIC-registered banks, he says consumers still have a lot of choices. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's 2 weeks till Labor Day, but kids are already going back to school. And you know what that means. Back to school shopping. Wall Street is hoping for healthy retail sales this month, which brings us to a new occasional segment.
This is the sound of money. $544 billion. That's how much public elementary and secondary schools are projected to spend this school year. Break that down and you get $11,000. That's the amount those schools will spend on each student. And those students are spending too. $902.22. That's how much the average college student will spend before heading to school. $83.8 billion. That's the total amount the National Retail Federation expects American K through college students and their families to spend this back-to-school season. By the way, that's up more than 11% from last year. Lesson over. Class dismissed.
The sound of money. And here's another one. The clickety-clack of a pair of Christian Louboutins walking down a hallway. Just one pair of that red-soled gorgeousness will set you back close to $1,000 for shoes. But you know what? Plenty of women spend a lot of time and money on shoes. And Rochelle Bergstein took note of that and wrote the new book, Women from the Ankle Down, The Story of Shoes and How They Define Us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I have to admit, this is a very difficult interview for me to have to do because I have a shoe problem.
Well, you are not alone. A lot of women do.
Why? What is it with shoes?
Well, there are a bunch of answers to that question, and I think the obvious reasons are definitely true. They are beautiful. They are works of art that you can wear on your feet. They spruce up an outfit. Even if you're wearing jeans and a t-shirt, if you have on a really gorgeous pair of shoes, you can look like $1,000,000. But what I found through this process is that shoes are more complicated than that also. They have come to represent all of these really subtle but important social cues, like status, like economic mobility, like independence, like power, like strength. And these things are such a potent brew that they contribute to making shoes so popular to this day.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of this, because I know you go into this in the book that, there is a history involved in women and their shoe obsessions.
There absolutely is. And what I found is that shoes have communicated status for a very, very long time. But I think it really exploded in the 20th century. Before the 20th century, shoes were made mostly by cobblers, and all but the most aristocratic women would buy shoes that were intended to last. There have been a lot of technological innovations in shoes in the 20th century. And so between manufacturing happening in factories as opposed to having shoes be handmade and having materials available that lower the cost of shoe production, women can start buying lots of shoes. You know, they can buy shoes based on whim, based on trend, based on their outfit. And that didn't happen until the 20th century.
You mentioned durability and shoes that were designed and, you know, meant to last for years and even be passed down from generation to generation. And it seems the opposite is true now. Even if they are meant to last, the fashion dictates that you can look completely out of it within 6 months.
Absolutely. And that's to the advantage of the manufacturers and the fashion industry.
Oh, I'm sure they design it exactly that way.
Absolutely. There is, in the sneaker world, it's called built-in obsolescence.
Yeah.
Products that last long aren't to the advantage of the people who are making money off of them. You know, we also live in a very frenetic world, and whereas in the 1940s and 50s, one or two styles of shoe would be in fashion at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are 20 styles of shoe that are in fashion. And on one hand, I think it is to encourage women to buy and buy and buy. On the other, women's lives have changed a lot. We're expected to do a lot more. So you would never wear the same shoes to work, to run after your children, to go to the gym, to go out to dinner. You know, there is more of a need to have an expansive wardrobe for women, I believe.
Given the fact that we are spending so much money on shoes, why are they so expensive? What goes into that?
Well, demand.
Yeah.
Shoes are so expensive because people will pay the amount that the designers are asking. There is certainly an issue of materials, an issue of labor, an issue of production costs. But honestly, shoes are so expensive because that's how highly people value them right now. We saw this happen with designer denim in the early 2000s. Jeans used to be $40 or $50, and that's how much people thought they should cost. And then there was a real influx of designer denim on the market, like Citizens of Humanity, like 7 Jeans,
right,
that cost upwards of $200. And when designers and manufacturers realized that people were willing to pay that, then that's how much jeans started to cost.
Rochelle Bergstein is the author of Women from the Ankle Down, The Story of Shoes and How They Define Us. What kind of shoes are you wearing right now, by the way?
I am wearing a pair of Michael Kors platform sandals.
Thanks so much for coming in. It's been fun.
Thank you.
It is hard to believe it's been 7 years since Hurricane Katrina slammed into the Gulf Coast. The anniversary of that horrific event comes up in a couple of weeks. Today we have several stories about the recovery effort that is still underway. One of the more remarkable features of Katrina was the diaspora created by hundreds of thousands of people leaving the area and never coming back. Many New Orleanians ended up going to Shreveport, north, and never coming back. Kate Archer Kent of Red River Radio reports on the storm's entrepreneurial awakening and a two-time refugee determined to restore his American dream.
From his second-story apartment overlooking the 17th Street Canal, Duck Young had a front-row view of water gushing into New Orleans. That image is the centerpiece of a photo collage on the wall of his restaurant in Bossier City near Shreveport, almost 350 miles from his former home. It's a mini Katrina memorial right next to the cash register for every customer to see.
I look at it every day and remind me of what devastation that Katrina have done and reason why that I'm up here. And to remind people, let people see how bad it is.
Deong was born in Vietnam. His refugee family came to New Orleans when he was 9. He says the U.S. government placed them there because his father, a fisherman, could land work right away. Young is a middle school dropout. At age 14, he went to work as a dishwasher and part-time shrimper. Over the years, he learned how to run the family restaurant in New Orleans. After the storm, Young's family scattered, his 5 siblings to cities in Louisiana and Texas. Only one moved back to New Orleans. His father made the most drastic change.
After the hurricane, my dad decided to just move back to Vietnam, never to come back here. Retire over there.
Deong used his $3,000 FEMA stipend to open a kiosk in the Bossier City Mall selling trinkets. As he got his bearings in his new city, he realized it lacked an authentic New Orleans po' boy shop. He sensed opportunity, but the banks wouldn't loan him the money, so he borrowed $100,000, not from a bank, but from family and friends to open Kim's seafood restaurant. All he says about that is that they believed in him, and a bank eventually came around.
8 months after I opened, Chase came and gave me a line of credit. When I first established, for the first 3 years or so, me and my wife never did take a day off.
Deong has since paid off his family with the help of a credit line, and Kim Seafood is profitable. Business owner Carl Roussel frequents the restaurant at least once a week. A regular from day one, Roussel is a fan of the crawfish po' boy, but it's Deong's sheer will that's made the biggest impression.
Foreign people, so to speak, come and they work. And, you know, they just put their mind in whatever it takes, you know. They 7 days a week until, you know, they figure out a way to be successful. And he's put out a good product, and so he's been very successful at it.
On this Katrina anniversary, for the first time, Deong plans to take a few days off to return to the Crescent City. He'll catch up with extended family, but he doesn't know how many of his siblings will make it back. And he says it's just a visit, nothing more.
I wouldn't move back, no. I love it here.
And it's an important business decision to be here.
Yes.
DeYoung will also see his daughter off to art college in California. She doesn't plan to pursue the restaurant business. He says his greatest gift is watching her follow her dream of education and a better life. I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
One big lesson of Katrina was the importance of insurance. The storm destroyed more than a million homes in the Gulf region, an estimated $135 billion in damages. And as we've already noted, it scattered the population to the wind. Longtime New Orleans realtor John Weil joins us to talk about the housing recovery there. Welcome.
Thank you, Tess. It's good to be here.
I was in New Orleans several months ago and drove around various parts of town. And I think it's fair to say that when it comes to the housing recovery there, it's really a mixed bag, isn't it?
It's an absolute mixed bag. It's area by area, yeah, extraordinaire.
And it seems to me that, you know, the areas that were hardest hit, you know, famous places like the Lower Ninth Ward, they just haven't come back.
Well, let's look at it this way. When Katrina hit in 2005, virtually 80% of New Orleans had to evacuate. That New Orleans and surrounding areas, which amounted to about a million people, which in and to itself was a phenomenal event. There were about 214,000 homes that had damage from Katrina. And the statistic as of July in 2009, one of the latest ones I could get, there were only about 60,000 homes of those 214 that were still some form of disrepair. So it's one thing to focus on the Ninth Ward, but in due respect, I think it's really important to look at New Orleans and surrounding areas as a whole. And as a whole, we've done a phenomenal job in reconstructing the city and getting it back up and running.
What is the real estate market like there then, particularly in parts of town that literally were underwater?
Well, the price per square foot, which is one measure to go by in those affected areas, is still down from the pre-Katrina days. Mm-hmm. But it's a difficult measure to look at because there is activity. It's not at a standstill. It's not as brisk as we'd like to see, but under the circumstances, it's in recovery. There was an article in Forbes in July that ranked New Orleans as the fastest growing city in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we're definitely on the road.
And what are those buyers looking for? Is there a certain type of house? Are they looking for homes that have been raised above flood level? Because I know that that's been an issue in some of the areas as well.
It has been, and it is an ongoing issue. Logic would have it that if you were going to buy in those lower line areas, that you would want it raised.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, on the other hand,
makes there it more expensive.
It does make it more expensive. There are programs right now, to offer help in the cost of raising the homes, but. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact is, you raise your home, you are in the hopes that everyone else around you is going to do it too, because you don't want to be the only one in your neighborhood living there.
Right.
So in those areas that are still struggling to rebound, that's one thing we're facing. We want to bring the neighborhoods back, and they are coming back.
Is there any concern on the part of folks in real estate like you that, you know, the threat that another Katrina could happen could keep the price of homes perpetually suppressed?
Well, you know, we have the benefit, if there is a benefit in an extraordinary event coming your way. We've got time on our hands to prepare. During Katrina, there were about 50 breaches in various areas of the city in the levee. So we are in the process of addressing those. The Corps of Engineers is doing a really good job in rebuilding them and substantiating them. This was an event that was extraordinary, and hopefully it's not likely to happen again, though, you know, we've been wounded, so we are a little snake bit by it.
John Weil is a realtor with Latter & Blum in New Orleans. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tess. It's been a great opportunity to talk about our city.
Looking at finance in New Orleans, 7 years post-Katrina. Loyal listeners may remember a few months ago we chatted with actor Wendell Pierce about a new line of grocery stores he was planning to open in the Crescent City. Fresh food can be a rare or at least expensive commodity in some lower-income neighborhoods. Pierce, perhaps best known for his roles in HBO's The Wire and Tremé, wants to change that. So he joins us now for a progress report. Good to have you back on the show.
It's good to be back.
First of all, I must offer congratulations for your Tony Award.
Yes, it was really wonderful. Cliburn Park, best play for 2011-2012 season of Broadway. So
I'm going to have to go and see that sometime. So earlier this year, we spoke with you about your plan to open this chain of grocery stores called Sterling Farms there in your hometown of New Orleans. What is the latest there? How's it going?
It is going well. As with all construction projects, there are always delays. We haven't opened the doors yet. Mm. We have a pilot convenience stores open. But we had our first community event where we gave over 500 families free groceries. And it was in conjunction with the Arena Football League. Mm. And it was fantastic. And I knew people needed it and wanted it and would be so appreciative, and that we would be able to earn their support by stepping off the sidelines and being that good corporate citizen and bringing in products and services that are needed, you know. Our focus is going to be on affordability and customer service, and I know that the community will respond to that, and it will lead to what I know can happen, where we can do well and do good all at the same time.
Well, it has been 7 years for that community and the rest of New Orleans since Katrina hit. And you're there now. You live there. I wonder if you could talk to us about what the spirit, what the mood is like around town.
It's actually a real sense of triumph. 80% of this city was destroyed. And to see that we are back in every part of the city, some places more than others, but back still the same, is amazing. People's resilience and focus and love for this city and their can-do spirit brought it back. Now, we have to be careful not to look at this renaissance through rose-colored glasses, as I always say. It's supposed to be one New Orleans and not just a tale of two cities. That we don't want, you know, a renaissance on the uptown side of Canal Street and not the downtown side.
Is that what's happening?
Well, yeah, we still have a lot of work to be done. Sometimes we've had a history of having a zero-sum mentality here in New Orleans. You know, I can't succeed without making sure you don't succeed. And we ultimately will not be able to become this renaissance New Orleans that we all desire. And that's the energy that you feel. That's the triumph that you feel. You know, there has to be an understanding that you don't have to be afraid of competition, that there's the more people that have access to schools and opportunity only means there's going to be more ideas, more innovation, and more growth, and builds more wealth. But I think that everyone realizes we have this window of opportunity and want to take advantage of it. So it's just a constant reminder that let this recovery be a recovery for all of New Orleans.
The third season of Tremé just wrapped up production there in May. I wonder, have you seen whether the show production has had an impact on the city in terms of its recovery, how people feel about it? What are people saying about the production there?
You know, it's life imitating art and art imitating life. Mm-hmm. And people around the city reflect on the show. It gives them hindsight. They love it at times. They hate it at times. It's reflective and therapeutic because they're able to look back, see where they were, realize the progress they've made and the progress they haven't made. And you have that hindsight to say, as we move forward, this is what's going to be different. I appreciate that. And so that's the impact of the show. Now, I was just in Paris shooting a film this summer. And then to hear someone in a thick Parisian French accent say, Antoine Baptiste, as you're walking down the street, oh, my chest was swelling with pride. And then walking back along the Seine, listening to some French kids playing New Orleans brass band music on the banks of the Seine by Yves Saint Louis was just magical. And it shows you that the impact of our culture of New Orleans is worldwide. And I greatly appreciated that.
You are well known for your knowledge of New Orleans cuisine. So for anyone who's planning to visit in the next couple of months, where do they have to go?
Oh, man. It's just the gut bucket, you know, down home. New Orleans experience on a Thursday night outside of the Hi-Ho Lounge with the Stooges brass band playing. There's a guy named Vittles with a big barbecue and having a hot sausage sandwich from him or a link or some barbecue chicken. It's really good.
All right. I'm booking my ticket. I'm going to be there tomorrow.
Good.
Actor and entrepreneur Wendell Pierce. The third season of Tremé is slated to premiere on HBO in September. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Anyone who's lived through a natural disaster knows the importance of preparation, and that includes your finances. The first step, of course, is to talk about it, and that is a tough step for a lot of couples. You'll often hear that we should set aside one night a month for discussions of the household budget, but New Orleans financial planner Jude Boudreau thinks that is not often enough. I met up with him a few months ago outside a Starbucks in the Garden District, and I asked him where couples who want to get a grip on their spending should start.
What I recommend for people is that they look at it once a week. If we take all the things in your budget, assume you're spending $5,000 a month, we don't need to track a lot of that because we know it's money that you've already spent. You have a house note, you have a car note, student loans, utilities. You know, we know with pretty good certainty what those regular monthly commitments are. What we do need to look at is what are we going to spend next week and what did we spend last week? You know, are we spending in line with our values? Are we making decisions that we're happy with? Are we communicating as a couple about what each other's spending money on? But if we get to having one 15-minute conversation a week, we should be able to predict with some reasonable certainty what we're going to spend next week.
But here you're saying that people can set aside 15 minutes a week to talk about their finances, which doesn't sound like a lot of time, but there are those who would argue that they don't have the 15 minutes. Plus, you have most couples who never talk about money, much less 15 minutes a week.
Sure.
So how do you get to that point where you're actually going to sit down and do it?
It takes some effort initially to get started in the process. It's going to take a while for you to both get some clarity about what's going on. And, you know, the first couple times you do it, it's going to take a little bit longer. But it's like most things with practice, it gets easier. As you start to see some of the benefits of it, like we're going to the gym, you don't see the benefits immediately, but if you can keep going and keep doing it regularly, you'll start to feel better about things, you'll start to see the benefits, and budgeting is very much the same way. But using tools like Mint.com, which can automate a lot of the process, pull in your transactions, automatically categorize some things for you, and the benefit of using a tool like that is ultimately over time you can see some trends too. You can go back and look at, you know, I've got almost 2 years worth of data in my personal one. So we can go and look at where our spending has changed over time, where we were spending things last year, where are we spending them this year. And you start to learn more about your own habits and behaviors along with that.
Why do you think money is so hard for us to talk about?
I think money is so hard to talk about in couples in particular because it's, it represents freedom in a lot of ways. It's rare that I work with couples where they both earn exactly the same or pretty close. Usually you have one with a much larger income, one that doesn't. And with that comes a lot of emotional baggage that I don't feel like I have enough say because I don't earn the money. Or I feel like I earn all the money, why don't I get to have any say? And those could be two people in the same relationship, and yet because they're not having a shared conversation about their values and about what they're trying to accomplish, then they both end up feeling this pull, like my needs aren't being met.
If you are in a relationship and you want to talk about this stuff, but it has never kind of been on the table to talk about, how do you approach that?
That's a great question. Occasionally you run across couples and their money beliefs are very compatible and things just kind of flow and work, and that's wonderful. However, that's not most people. Often there's, opposites attract. There's no getting around it. 90% of the couples I've ever worked with, one was a spender, one was a saver. I think just having the courage to bring it up and take some initial steps, to have some conversations around your goals and, what if we could do anything in the world, what would we do if money wasn't a concern? I think that's a great place to start. We can start from abundance and start to have a conversation around that. Sometimes things will come up that wouldn't otherwise, we may never ever talked about with our spouse or partner. And so we can use that as a starting point for helping us live those things and actually make meaningful progress towards those really important goals and those things that we're really about as a person.
Jude Boudreau, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Jude is a certified financial planner and the founder of Upper Line Financial Planning in New Orleans. Jazz bassist Michael Harris had a house in the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans, five blocks from where a levee broke. He lost the house and everything he'd ever owned in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. I met Harris last fall during that trip to the Big Easy. We talked in his new house in the Upper Ninth Ward, an area known as Musician's Village, filled with riotously colorful homes. It's a Habitat for Humanity project conceived by Harry Connick Jr. and Branford Marsalis. Over a small dining table, he told how he survived the financial devastation of the storm.
I was on tour in Brazil at the time when the storm hit. And when I got back stateside, I got as far as Dallas. And the last flight that they had coming to New Orleans, it didn't make any sense to catch the flight, so I rerouted to Houston. And en route, my luggage got lost. I arrived in Houston literally with the clothes on my back, my bass, my passport, my driver's license, and thank God I had my bass with me. I had my instrument. The area that I lived in, that was the last area that they actually allowed the citizens to return to. And when they did, they had a policy in effect that said, look and leave. What struck me was when I was actually able to get back to see my home, or what was left of it, it wasn't where I left it. I knew it was bad, but nothing could prepare you for the severity of it. Financially, when the storm hit, no, I wasn't prepared. I don't think anyone was. The life of a musician is not easy. And the truth of the matter is I really didn't know what was going to happen next. Financially, my survival after the storm came from generous donations from so many different individuals and nonprofits, Music Cares, and so many other Sweet Home New Orleans. I didn't have the insurance, and I didn't even deal with the road home and all that kind of stuff. I'm not a the type of person that just squanders money. You know, I really try to manage it and stretch every dollar and maximize it. And that's what helped me to survive. When things finally picked up as far as playing gigs, working, you know, playing music and everything, then from there I just manage and budget, and that's how I survive. It was at least about a year before I was able to work steadily, and even that was great too, because a lot of people, you know, were saying, you know, should they rebuild, or should the people come back or whatever, and to be back home in this city playing music, you know, doing what I love to do, I just knew everything was going to be okay. I just knew it. Not even having the opportunity to actually evacuate, it's like, you know, but oddly enough, you learn to let go of the material things. And what you do is you hold on to the memories and you cherish them and you hold them near and dear in your heart. If this were to ever happen again, a storm, something of this magnitude, I think that financially, I would be in a much better place, a much better state of affairs, yes, absolutely. My saving, 10% of everything you earn is yours to keep, and I live by that religiously. You can set it aside, you can save it. You pay everybody else, you pay bills, you do everything that is normally required in society, but 10% you're allowed to set aside for a rainy day, and that means to save. And you do it and you don't even miss it. You pay everybody else. Why not pay yourself? God bless the child that's got his own. How can you provide for others if you're not together? And it comes back. Right about now, I'm pretty much prepared for anything. Who knows? The next minute is not guaranteed. It's not promised. Take nothing for granted. Enjoy as much natural and man-made beauty as possible. Enjoy life. I'm happy. I'm happy. I am.
New Orleans jazz bassist Michael Harris. That music, by the way, is his original composition. It's called Unity. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Tess Vigeland. Next time, you might want to think twice before buying certain items secondhand.
I got my breast pump new. I know people that have gotten them used. I personally made the decision to get a new one. But I've had people come in and ask if we have them.
People sell them on Craigslist. I've seen them.
They do.
Oh, yeah, okay. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Special thanks this week to Millie Jefferson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Yore. I am Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week. This is APM.